On Sunday, November 13th at 11 p.m., Suge and My Bowl presents a celebration of the New York City premiere of Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary, being featured at Doc NYC. Join us as we discuss Chasing Train with veteran documentarian John Scheinfeld. That's Sunday, November 13th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Suge and My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guests for this evening are Doc NYC Director of Programming, Basil Tsiokas, and veteran documentarian John Scheinfeld, who will be discussing his film, which will be featured as part of the closing evening event of Doc NYC, Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Suge and My Bowl, coming up now.
Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Basil Tsiokas.
Basil Tsiokas, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl and discussing Doc NYC.
Absolutely.
My first question for you, actually something that I noticed, Doc NYC seems to not just screen films these days. It is now referred to as a conference.
Well, we actually have always had industry programming side of the festival since the very beginning with panels and master classes for working filmmakers. And so for several years now, we've been building that up, and it's kind of a concurrent part of the festival that takes place during the day. So we definitely have not left the films behind. We have plenty of them to go around, but we also have a lot of panels that are really, really great. Everything from first-time filmmakers to established documentarians who want to know more about their craft.
Wonderful. How do you choose the films that are going to be screened?
I'm the director of programming for the festival. I work with Tom Powers, who is our artistic director, and I oversee the bulk of the programming. We receive thousands of submissions from filmmakers each year. I have a team that includes a shorts programmer and an associate programmer who help to go through the work. And then I also attend lots of festivals. Tom and I also work for other festivals that are pretty high profile, including Sundance in Toronto. So we're able to see work there that we want to bring to the festival. So it's a combination of all that. We try to select the films that we think speak to developments in documentary, to audiences in New York City who are going to want to see this work, and films that we just love that we want to expose to as broad an audience as possible.
Your opening and closing films in particular. I'm so excited about both of them. Citizen Jane is the opening film. How did you come across that one?
So that one is a good example of sort of the kinds of films that Tom Powers brings to the festival. That was a film that debuted at the Toronto Film Festival. It is a great, great film. It's such a perfect way to kick off Doc NYC. For the audience that doesn't know, it's about Jane Jacobs, who was a tireless advocate for the city of New York, and in the 1960s fought back against development plans that would have destroyed mass areas of the city to build the highways that would have just destroyed places like Soho. And it is a really fantastic story about how ordinary people can fight back against City Hall, essentially.
Jane was the opposite of Roy Cohn. Or actually, no. Who am I thinking? Oh, my gosh.
Robert Moses.
Thank you, Robert Moses. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm sure she would have been against Roy Cohn, too.
But, probably. And your closing film is the Coltrane film.
Yeah. It's called Chasing Train. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a film that is tailor-made for music lovers. It really does a fantastic job of sort of demonstrating what makes John Coltrane's music so phenomenal. It focuses on his entire life, but really shows off the kinds of work he was doing that was so innovative in jazz. And that was another film that Tom was part of in terms of bringing it to Toronto. So we're thrilled to have the New York City premiere of that film as well.
And the thing that's really special about that, I think, is the sort of scarcity of information or recorded information of Coltrane, his voice, his image. It's sort of limited. Yeah. I think it relies a lot on interviews.
True. Mm-hmm. There has not been a lot out there. Yeah, it's true. But there's a lot of fantastic music, and there's a lot of great admirers of his work that are included in this that really speak to his appeal. So I think audiences are going to really love this film.
Well, one of the people that I'm really glad that's involved in it is Ashley Kahn. He wrote one book about Impulse Records in particular, but then he wrote about Coltrane and A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album. So it's really cool that he's involved, and he's actually doing some voice work as well. He's probably reading from his book.
Yeah, Love Supreme is very much a subject in the film, and it's got such a range of people that have been influenced and that just are big Coltrane fans, like Cornel West to Kamasi Washington to Bill Clinton. It's a great, diverse group of people that speak to the power of the music today.
free, love the 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 free.
Anything John plays, anything John writes, is beyond, unquestionably beyond.
Coltrane gave another dimension to American music in the 20th century. His music was deeply rooted in the Afro-American experience and in the American experience, and with Coltrane, because of his studies and his seriousness, the human experience.
John Coltrane has set aside some time, and he secludes himself above the garage in his house at Dix Hills, Long Island, to put together what he sees as a suite. He doesn't know how it's going to go. He has some loose melodies, some ideas. A few days later, he comes down the stairs, and as Mrs. Coltrane put it, it was like Moses coming down from the mountain.
I always liken it to like looking at the sun. It's like hearing John Coltrane, it's like the brightest light you can hear.
He is an archangel of the highest order to bring healing in this planet. Period.
All praise to God. This album is a humble offering to Him, an attempt to say, thank you, God, through our work, even as we do through our hearts and with our tongues. May He help and strengthen all men in every good endeavor.
I think I play that album more than I play any other album in my life.
I just thought, oh my God, you know, this guy, his mind and his heart, his soul, they're in a place that everybody ought to reach for.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
John Scheinfeld.
John Scheinfeld, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I appreciate the time you're going to spend with us.
Well, happy to be here. Thanks for the interest.
First off, because, of course, one has to wonder, why this movie? Why John Coltrane?
Why John Coltrane? Well, I have done probably close to 45 documentaries, by far the majority about musicians. I love musicians. I love music. I love peeling away the layers of the onion to see what makes an artist tick. Where does the art come from? What were those events in their lives that helped shape them and mold them into the people and the artist that they became? And one of our producers, Spencer Proffer, had come to me and said, what do you think about doing a feature documentary about John Coltrane? And I like Coltrane. I didn't know a lot about him. I know my favorite things, and I know A Love Supreme.
Right.
But I didn't know a lot about his story. But the more I read about him, the more I felt this is a story that needs to be told. And it's a different kind of story. We're all used to the story, we've seen this a million times, of artist comes from nowhere, has great talent, abuses drugs,
right,
has financial problems, falls into the abyss and dies young. You know,
yeah,
we've seen that story.
This is not that story.
This is not that story. And that's really what attracted me to it, is that it's a story of a man who did have challenges in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And as President Bill Clinton, who's in the film, says so eloquently, he looked into the abyss, Coltrane did, realized he could go down and die, or he could go up and be greater than he ever was. And so he kicked his heroin addiction, and it's at that point that he begins to ascend, and he begins to write better, play better, and becomes John Coltrane, the icon. So to me, this is a very inspiring and uplifting story of someone who overcame their obstacles to achieve great things. And that, to me, is a wonderful story.
Well, I know that this has to be a challenge, the way you went about telling the story, considering the lack of footage that's available on John Coltrane, of visual footage and audio. How did you decide to approach it?
That's an excellent, excellent question. Those were our challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Was, yes, how do you illustrate the art of someone where you don't have a lot of performance footage? What we did have were several TV concerts that had been broadcast in Europe, so we had those to work with. We had thousands of photos to choose from. And in fact, in the film, as I hope your listeners will see when they come to see it, is there are probably over 500 photos that no one has seen before. We cast a very wide net around the globe and came away with some really extraordinary things. And we also had some home movies to work with. And so all of that helped visually. But there's a definite visual style to the film that makes up for the fact that we were missing a lot of concert footage. But one of our biggest challenges was I wanted Coltrane to be an active participant in the film beyond just the performance clips. And as you noted, he did no TV interviews during his lifetime. He did a handful of radio interviews.
Right. One of them, as a matter of fact, was provided by Frankowski for Pacifica.
Yes, that is correct.
Do you think that learning how to play the soprano had anything to do with the change in your style from what it had been, say, in 57?
Definitely, definitely.
How so? Could you
spell
it out?
Well, the soprano, by being this small instrument, I found that playing the lowest note on it was like playing the one of the middle notes in the tenor.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, after I got so I could, my armature would allow me to make the upper notes,
mm-hmm,
I found that I would play all over this instrument, you see. And on tenor, I hadn't always played all over it because I was playing certain ideas, which were just running certain ranges, octaves.
Mm-hmm.
But by playing on the soprano and becoming accustomed to playing from that low B flat on up, it soon got so when I went to tenor, I found myself doing the same thing, you see. And this caused the change of the willingness to change and just try to play the, you know, as much of the instrument as possible.
Did it give you a new rhythmic conception too?
I think so. A new shape came out of this thing and patterns, you know, the way the patterns would fall.
It seemed to me that after you started playing soprano, and particularly after My Favorite Things, then you started feeling that same kind of a pulse on the tenor that hadn't been there in your work
before. In fact, soprano is one of the reasons I started getting dissatisfied with that tenor mouthpiece, see? Because the sound of that soprano was actually so much closer to me in my ear. So there's something about the presence of that sound, you know, that to me, I didn't want to admit it, but to me it was seeming like it was better than the tenor. I liked it more, see? And I didn't want to admit this damn thing, because I said, well, the tenor is my horn. This is my favorite. But this soprano, maybe it's just the fact that it's a higher instrument. It started pulling my conception, you see? Really was headed going into this instrument.
How do you feel about the two horns now?
Well, the tenor is the power horn, definitely. But soprano, there's still something there in just the just the voice of it. It's really beautiful.
Awesome.
I really like.
Do you regard the soprano as an extension of the tenor, or?
Well, at first I did, but I don't know. It's just now. It's another voice.
Do you ever use the two horns on the same piece like you did on Spiritual?
I think that's the only time I've done that. Sometimes in clubs, if I feel good, I might do something like this. Start on one and end on another, you know. But I think that's the only one on record that was like that.
What prompted Farrow to take up the alto? Was that to get away from the tenor sound?
I don't know. This
is talking over with him.
No, this is something he wanted to do, and it was about the same time I decided I wanted to get one. So we both got it.
I haven't heard you play the alto yet. Do you play it much?
I played it in Japan. I played it in Frisco a little bit, but I've had a little trouble on with the intonation of it. It's a Japanese make that they, new thing they're trying out, so they gave us these horns to try. And mine has to be adjusted at certain points where they're not quite in tune, so I don't play it, but I like it.
I saw a picture of you with a flute.
Yeah.
Are you playing that too now?
I'm learning.
You're always learning, aren't you?
I hope so. I'm always trying to learn.
And that's one of them, although that's really a good example of what we had to work with, is that what Coltrane said in that interview was quite fascinating, but the sound was not good, and it was not something that we could use, and really the other radio interviews were very similar.
Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guests for this evening are John Scheinfeld, who is the director of Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary. We heard earlier from Basil Tsiokas, who is the director of programming of DocNYC, where Chasing Train will be featured as the closing evening event on November 17th. We'll hear more from Basil at the end of the program. What you're listening to right now is To Be from John Coltrane's Expression. That's a 1967 Impulse Records release. John Coltrane on tenor saxophone, Jimmy Garrison on bass, Alice Coltrane on piano, Rashid Ali on drums. However, on this recording, John Coltrane is playing flute and Pharoah Sanders is on piccolo flute. Unfortunately, Pharoah Sanders is not featured in the documentary, but we thought we'd give him some voice here on Sugar in My Bowl. Before that, we heard an excerpt from the John Coltrane interview that was conducted by Frank Kofsky. This interview in its entirety is in the Pacifica Radio Archives. It was recorded in 1966, and you can still get your hands on it by going to give2WBAI.org. And I'll take this moment to thank those who did show their financial support for WBAI during the fall drive. Before that, we heard the film trailer for Chasing Train, and before that, we heard part one, Acknowledgement, from John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. Often people refer to this as A Love Supreme. It is actually part one, Acknowledgement. And this is a 1965 Impulse Records release. John Coltrane on tenor saxophone, Jimmy Garrison on bass, McCoy Tyner on piano, and Elvin Jones on drums. Before that, we heard Wise One from the John Coltrane Quartet. Crescent is the name of that release. It's a 1964 Impulse Records. John Coltrane on tenor and soprano saxophone, Jimmy Garrison on bass, McCoy Tyner on piano, and Elvin Jones on drums. And before that, we heard our theme, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from Nina Simone, the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. It's an RCA BMG release that was originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams, and stay tuned for more of Sugar in My Bowl with the filmmaker, John Scheinfeld. And we'll hear later, toward the end, from Basil Tsiokas, who is the director of programming of Doc NYC. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
happily, he had done many print interviews during his life. And so what I did is I took extracts from those print interviews and I peppered them throughout the film to illuminate what he might have been thinking or feeling at a particular time. And because I am relentlessly optimistic and I always aim high, I wanted those words to be read by a movie star.
Yes.
So I put together a list of five actors that I thought would be appropriate for this.
Huh.
And joyously, I didn't have to go to choices 2 through 5. I found a way to get to my first choice, and he said yes, and
wow.
He's wonderful, and it's Denzel Washington.
Indeed. Yay.
And one of the reasons he was, aside from the fact he's a superb actor, is if you look at the roles that he tends to play in the movies, many of them are characters with a quiet strength.
Exactly.
And by all accounts, from what people told me, that New Coltrane, is that that's a perfect description of him. He was a man of quiet strength.
Right.
And so Denzel reads the words of John Coltrane throughout the film, and he's just terrific. He really makes Coltrane come alive, because very few people have ever heard his voice to begin with. But he just found a way to bring these passages alive and really elevates the entire Coltrane portrait that we were able to create.
Now, did you rely on, for the interviews, there was a book of interviews that was made available. Was that one of the sources that you used?
That was one of many sources. He did a lot of interviews with various newspapers and magazines and all those sorts of things. And so we could really pull from many different sources. And it was a bit of a challenge, to be honest, because in many of these interviews, he would be talking about something that was happening right at that moment. And what I needed him to do was to talk about some of those events and people in his life that helped make him who he was. And ultimately, we found everything that we wanted. And there's a nice progression to it, and as I say, it really elevates the portrait of Coltrane.
Does the film span from a particular period, childhood, to his ascension?
I didn't want to do a traditional biography where, you know, he was born in 1926. and so what we do is that it's really highlights of a life. And it is structured very cinematically, where we start at a moment of crisis in his life, and then we flash back to reveal how we got here, and then we keep moving forward, showing those events that were most critical in terms of his development. And I also wanted, honestly, to take the audience to some unexpected places. And so we do that. There are a number of sequences in the film that when you or your listeners come to see it, I hope you will be sitting in the theater and say, what does this have to do with John Coltrane? Why are we here in this moment talking about this thing? And then we always bring it around. And I think in some ways it's very much my style as a filmmaker. There's an old cliche in Hollywood where, in storytelling, tell them what they're going to see, tell them what they saw. Very obvious and very much on the nose. And I much prefer to introduce something that's a bit of a surprise or a bit of why are we here, and then we come around and say, oh, okay, that's why this has something to do with something. And to me, that always keeps the audience engaged and keeps the storytelling moving forward and keeps it fresh.
Do you want to give a teaser of one of those examples?
Sure. Coltrane, one of his most remarkable compositions is called Alabama, and he wrote it as a tribute to the 4 young girls who were murdered in a church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963.
Yeah, the 16th Street.
Yes, at the hands of the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
And we do tell the story of that composition and how he came to do it. But how we get into it is we take you in a very unexpected place to first introduce the social, political, and cultural landscape of that time, and then we bring Coltrane into it. And so that's one example.
That's very good. I like that a lot.
And there are a number of others throughout the course of the film, because I think we are all byproducts of our background, whether it's childhood, whether it's teen years, whether it's adulthood, whatever. All of the experiences we have help form who we are. And
right.
Coltrane absolutely was like that. He was a byproduct not only of his childhood, but also of the Jim Crow South in which he was raised, and then the jazz scene in New York in the late 40s through the late 50s, and many different things that came with that. That's one example, and there are many others. And so what I hope the VAI listeners will find is that they will be on the edge of their seat sort of wondering, okay, where's the story taking us now?
Very nice.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for November 13th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's show features John Scheinfeld, director of Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary. And you can catch it this week on the 17th at the SVA Theater in Manhattan, and that's part of the Doc NYC Festival. And thanks to any of you who supported us during WBAI's Fall Fun Drive, and if you didn't get around to it, it's not too late. The Support WBAI link on our site takes you to the station's donation page. And let's get to our music listings for this week. Pianist and keyboardist Mark Carey leads the Focus Trio at Smoke on the 14th. Saxophonist Gary Bartz is at the Blue Note on the 14th with pianist McCoy Tyner, and on the 21st with trumpeter Wallace Roney. He also leads the Head of State Trio, and that's at Smoke, from the 18th through the 20th. Pianist Michelle Rosewoman will be at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem for a talk on the Afro-Cuban beat on the 15th. Harpist Brandy Younger is at Newark, New Jersey's Gateway Center for a lunchtime set on the 16th, and that's part of the James Moody Jazz Festival. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls on the 16th. Percussionist Steve Croon leads a sextet at Smoke on the 17th. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria leads a multiverse big band at Aaron Davis Hall on the City College of New York's Harlem campus, and that's on the 18th. That's for a birthday tribute and retirement party for legendary percussionist Candido Camero. Bassist Christian McBride leads a James Brown tribute at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark on the 18th, and that's part of the James Moody Jazz Festival. Christian McBride and vocalist Diane Reeves are going to be at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center on the 19th for a Sarah Vaughan tribute, and that's part of the Moody Jazz Festival also. Looking a little further ahead, vibraphonist Gary Burton is at the Blue Note as part of pianist Chick Corea's Miles Davis tribute from the 22nd to the 23rd. Also joining Chick Corea at the Blue Note is saxophonist Ravi Coltrane. He'll be there from the 25th to the 27th. And for a Return to Forever tribute, also with Corea, from the 30th to December 4th. Bassist Henry Grimes is at Harlem's Rendell Memorial Presbyterian Church on the 25th. See harlemjazzbox.com for details. That's harlemjazzbox.com, and box has three X's. Low brass specialist on tuba Joe Daly will be at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 26th. Drummer Jeff Tane Watts is at St. Peter's Church in Manhattan on the 29th with several other musicians for a benefit concert for the Syrian American Medical Society. Finally, drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun's gallery exhibit of his visual art collaboration Azza continues at the Bronx Music Heritage Center through February. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you see something good, we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with friends. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website for details. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online, and be back on WBAI on Sunday, November 27th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand. Thank you.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
Persons who are living today that you chose to include in the film to interview, how did you decide your choice?
Right. When I start a film, I'm always thinking who should be interviewed. There's some obvious choices, but I want to cast these voices much as one would cast a scripted film. So I want them each to have a different personality, different way of speaking, a different style, a different perspective, so that no one person in the film sounds like anyone else. So I really divided it into three parts. First part is we wanted people that knew Coltrane and could speak with credibility and legitimacy to who he was as a person and how he developed as an artist. And so we went to jazz legend Benny Golson, who knew John from the time they were both 16. And Benny is extraordinarily eloquent and brilliant in his perspective. So loved him. We went to Jimmy Heath, who met Coltrane right around the same time in Philadelphia. And Jimmy's a little more serious, little more edge to him, but also could speak to Coltrane the man. And then we went to legend of legends in the jazz world, Sonny Rollins, who has a very unique way of speaking and has a very unique take on the world and Coltrane's place in it. Mm-hmm. So those are some examples. Then I wanted family members.
Right.
And so we have three of his children from the second marriage, Michelle, Ravi, and Aran. And I was so excited. He had a stepdaughter from his first marriage to Naima. And her name is Antonia.
Okay.
And Antonia had never, ever given an interview in her life.
Wow.
Not to print, not to radio, not to TV, nothing. And it took me months to persuade her to bare her soul. And I think it was a very cathartic experience for her. And for me as a filmmaker, it was just rich and a real treasure to have someone who was there
right.
to speak to some of the critical years in Coltrane's life, but also could speak to him as a father.
Sure.
What was he like as a father?
Thank you.
have a story very early on. I'm not going to spoil it for you and your listeners, but there's a story very early on in the film that Antonia tells that just explains in a very economical way what a wonderful father he was and what a wonderful human being he was. So that's all terrific. And then the third portion of this is I wanted people who were inspired by Coltrane, either in their art or their scholarship, to talk about him. So we have Common, we have Wynton Marsalis, we have Carlos Santana, we have John Densmore, the drummer of the Doors, who actually saw Coltrane on stage and could speak to that experience. We have Wayne Shorter, who knew him. Mm-hmm. And then we have a real young up-and-comer, Kamasi Washington.
Exactly.
Is in the film, who's terrific and uh-huh. has a very unique way of speaking. Mm-hmm. So he stands out from the others. And then part of this portion of people that were inspired by him, in all of my films, I like to have some people that are unexpected. It's like, what are they doing in this film?
Like Bill Clinton.
Exactly. And so I'll tell you a story. My wife and I had been watching the David Letterman show last year, in the last 2 weeks before he retired. And the president was on one night, and he was telling a story of how he picked up the saxophone at age 10, and he was obsessed with it all the way through high school. And he got more scholarship offers for his musicianship to college than he did for his academics.
Wow.
And he seriously thought about becoming a professional musician. And then he paused, and he said, but then I realized I was no John Coltrane. And so I looked at my wife, and I said, there's a story there. So we reached out to his staff, and almost immediately it came back, and these are their words, the president would find much joy in this.
Oh, my.
But we're chasing him for 10 months between his very busy schedule, and as you may have noticed during this election year, his wife was keeping him a little busy.
Exactly.
It was really hard to find a time in the schedule, but early June this year, I get a call on a Friday that says, Tuesday, 2:30, his office in New York, see you there.
Wow.
So I jumped on a plane and we went. And I must tell you, it wasn't one of these, I just really like John Coltrane. The president was articulate and eloquent and passionate and knowledgeable about Coltrane. And there are a good half dozen memorable sound bites that he delivers that just cut to the heart of who Coltrane was and why here he is some 50 years after his death is still inspiring people. Mm. That was terrific.
Thank you.
I wanted a cultural historian who could speak to the African-American experience in America, the Jim Crow South, the world of the 50s and 60s in which Coltrane lived and worked. And I always was a fan of Cornel West.
Oh, yes.
Again, a very distinctive voice. So imagine my surprise and my luck that not only could he speak to the times and the context and the African-American experience, but he's a huge Coltrane fan.
Oh,
he knew recording dates. He knew producers. He knew sidemen. And what you see in the film is a wonderful blend of knowledge and passion. And he's a terrific voice in the film. So the combination of all these voices really bring Coltrane and his impact and influence alive.
There's one of the voices, well, he's a favorite around here at Sugar My Bowl, Ashley Kahn. And just hearing in the trailer his reading an excerpt from the book, A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album, is just amazing.
We needed experts on Coltrane who could speak more to overview. They didn't know him, but they have a very professional perspective on his life and career. And Ashley is one of those, and he's all the way through the film, and he's terrific. Another author who's written a wonderful book on Coltrane is Lewis Porter. And Lewis also has some wonderful observations. And so the two of them kind of carry the historical part of the story, and they add some spice and color and texture to the rest of the film.
It's wonderful. Now, are you attending for a Q&A, the closing event at Doc NYC?
I wouldn't miss it for the world. The gentleman who runs the festival, Tom Powers, has been a supporter of my work for some time now, and he also runs the documentary program at the Toronto International Film Festival.
Right.
And we had the international premiere up there at the TIFF.
Mm-hmm.
And he's such a fan of the film, he said, please, 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 will you come and be our closing night gala presentation? And I thought, that's great. We hadn't shown it in New York. And the film goers in New York are terrific. And so, yes, I will be there. I'm going to introduce the film, tell some interesting behind-the-scenes stories, I hope. And then we'll do a Q&A after.
That is great. Hopefully I can squeeze in between all the other billions of people who will be clamoring to get in.
I hope you come. And Joyce, if you do, you got to come up and introduce yourself.
I will, definitely.
But I will say, I'm very proud of this film.
Mm-hmm.
My goal always is to do justice to the subjects, but
yes.
I felt even more pressure to do that with an iconic figure like John Coltrane. And the response that we got at the Telluride Film Festival, the Toronto Festival, and all the other people who have seen it now has been so positive, and that we really captured who he was, and I didn't know that. And I mean, mm-hmm. Denzel being a good example, when we were talking about it, when I was trying to persuade him to do it, he said, you know, I know 5 or 6 of the albums, and I love the music, but I don't really know much about his life. And part of persuading him to do is I had to show him an early cut of the film. So we sent him a secure link that he could watch on his computer because he was in Pittsburgh directing and starring in an adaptation of August Wilson's Fences.
Yes.
So 5 days go by, and I don't hear from him. So I'm convinced he hates it, and I'm never going to hear from him. And then my phone rings, and there's no caller ID, it says on it, and I pick it up, and he doesn't say hello, and he doesn't say, hi, it's Denzel. He just goes, it's beautiful, brother. When are you coming to Pittsburgh? So I flew to Pittsburgh and we recorded him there. But what he did say was after he saw the film, so much more of Coltrane's music made sense to him.
Mm.
And I think that's the experience that anyone who comes to the film is going to have. We did not create a film for jazz buffs only.
Okay.
We created a film for average film goers who might have heard the name Coltrane. Maybe they know a little bit of the music. And the film is not about the music. It's about the man. And that's what I find most interesting as a filmmaker, as we discussed earlier. And that's what we tried to accomplish with this film, which is bring him alive as a 3-dimensional human being that people could understand, feel for, be intrigued by, and then want to go out and hear some of his music. And to that end, one of the great things here is we had an agreement with the Coltrane family. We had an agreement with the three record labels that collectively own his material.
What's that, Riverside, and, Impulse, and
Well, you
Atlantic?
Know, all the mergers and consolidations.
Oh, okay. But the original...
It's like three companies now.
Oh,
it's Universal
okay.
Music Group, Warner Music Group, and the Concord Music Group.
Okay, okay.
And because of these agreements, we were able to use as much music as we wanted to.
Wonderful.
And so there are 48 Coltrane recordings in the film.
Wow.
Which for a documentary is always wonderful and rare because the costs involved, sometimes you can't afford to have too much music.
Exactly.
In something. And but we have 48 tracks from the very first recording he made when he was a 20-year-old kid in the Navy to the very last recording he made before he passed away from liver cancer. And in between, you're going to hear classic Coltrane, you're going to hear some rare Coltrane, and you're going to hear some essential Coltrane.
Okay.
And what I wanted to do was not to just, oh, here's a song. We were limited by what performance clips existed, so those performances are what they are. But how I wanted to use the music was a little different. I wanted to have it be as if he were still alive and I had hired him to score the film.
Ah, nice.
So that most of these 48 songs appear at a place in time and a place in his story where the feel and the tempo and the emotion, the music fits what's happening in the story. And what I found in his extraordinary body of work is almost every mood, every emotion, every texture that I needed to make a scene really work. And that was a wonderful luxury for us.
When you mention the music and what documentarians come up against with regard to licensing, is there a limit on how long you can use this music? Because I know of another documentary in particular, they couldn't release on DVD because they had to get licensing rights or what have you. Is that something that you're dealing with right now or would have to deal with in the future?
Sure. Any film, television show that uses music has the same challenges. You have to pay twice.
Okay.
You pay for the master recording, so that's the artist that did the song. So say we use Blue Train by Coltrane. Mm-hmm. We have that recording, so we have to pay the record company that owns it, and then they have their share that they pay to the artist. But you also must pay the writer of the song. And so you're really paying double, same cost usually, for each song that's in the film. So you pay for the master recording and you pay for the writer who wrote the composition. And what you then must do is license those rights, both the master recording and the writer, for a package of rights. And that could be television only, could be theatrical only, could be DVD only, could be foreign only. And so it's sort of a step by step. And what we all try to do is to buy all those rights so that there's no limitation on where you can release your film. But sometimes if the budget of a film or television show isn't high enough, then what you do is you buy the rights that you absolutely need, and then, yes, you either can't release it on DVD or you have to come back and negotiate a price for DVD when you're ready to do that. The advantage we have on this film, and honestly what I've had on most of my films, because I work with the estates and the labels, is you make an arrangement where for a reasonable amount of money you get to use all the music that you want. And here we are. We're doing a film about a musician. It ought to be jam-packed with music.
Wow.
So we're real fortunate in that regard. And I think, again, it elevates the entire film-going experience, because the other thing I do in my films is I generally have wall-to-wall music, very little free spots where there's nothing going on. And I just find that creates a tapestry of sound that, again, helps tell the story.
And just to give the listeners an example, anyone who saw the U.S. versus John Lennon, that was clear there. And who is Harry Nilsson? That was clear in that movie as well, which I thought both of those were excellent, excellent treatment.
Thank you for mentioning them. In the Lennon film, we had about 52 songs.
Oh,
and
wow.
In the Harry film, we had 56. But an interesting difference in those films is because they are singers, singer-songwriters, there are lyrics.
Right.
And in those two films, I use the lyrics to advance the story, either commenting on the action we're seeing on screen or telling us what people might have been thinking or feeling at that moment by what the lyrics are. Coltrane was a different kind of challenge because there's no vocals,
right,
except on one album, the Johnny Hartman album. So what it did, as we discussed before, is that it really allowed me to have a credit on the film, music by John Coltrane.
Excellent.
It's all his music in one way, shape, or form.
Wow, that's wonderful. And there's one thing I thought that was really great. The first thing I noticed when I was reading about the existence of the film, that the family was with it. They were supportive, right there with you.
Yes. To tell the story properly, I always feel you have to make this authorized.
Mm-hmm.
A number of docs aren't. They just go ahead and tell the story, and you don't have the benefit of working with the family. And they've been really supportive. We got home movies from them. We got photos from them. Just to be able to work with them adds more credibility to our film, and that's a great thing. I was working with Yoko on the U.S. versus John Lennon, and I was working with Harry Nilsson's family. He passed away some years before, but I worked with his family on that, and always feel much more comfortable doing that.
Well, there's one thing I could definitely guarantee for anyone who sees this film and who goes back and watches the other two, just as an example of your work, that I did learn something from both U.S. versus John Lennon and the Harry Nilsson film.
Nice of you to say, and I hope you will feel, and your listeners will feel the same way about Coltrane. There's a lot of interesting aspects to his character. And again, with all these unique voices, we come at it from different perspectives. Sonny Rollins, for example, has a quote in the film, something to the effect of, John was a genius. Bach survives, Beethoven survives. I don't think we should be afraid to put John on their level.
Hear, hear.
And Carlos Santana, who was very much influenced by Coltrane and, in fact, has played a Love Supreme a number of times over the years, had a wonderful way of characterizing Coltrane. He said, some people play jazz, some people play reggae, some people play blues. He played life.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, I love that. Gotta love that. And here's another one. Cornel West and I have become quite friendly, and he brought a really interesting comparison here. He said Martin Luther King and John Coltrane go hand in hand. He says, why? He says, because they're love warriors. They represent the best of the human spirit. Everyone has something to learn from the genius of Martin Luther King and John Coltrane. And now to put Coltrane on the same plane as Martin Luther King will tell you so much about this iconic artist. Very important. And the last thing I'll just throw out is there's a wonderful quote that I found from an interview that Coltrane had done that Denzel really brings to life. And this is a paraphrase now because it's actually a longer quote, but Coltrane said, I myself don't recognize the word jazz. I just feel that I play John Coltrane. And I think that's one of the messages here of this extraordinary artist, is that his sound, the emotion in his sound, the technical playing, but the spirituality behind it is so unique. And it's why here we are in almost 50 years since he passed away, and we're still talking about him. And people are still finding themselves influenced by him. And to me, that is remarkable.
Well, thank you so much, John Scheinfeld, for providing such a broad scope of John Coltrane. And we will see you at Doc NYC on the 17th of November as the closing night presentation for the festival / conference. Thank you so much.
We're at 7 o'clock at the SBA Theater, Lower Manhattan.
Thank you for that.
And tickets are now available on the Doc NYC site if people want to come. I understand tickets are selling, and
yes,
so I would hate for anybody to miss this.
Well, thank you so much, John Scheinfeld. Is there anything else you want to share?
I don't think so. You asked some really smart and good questions, so I think that's terrific. You're terrific. Thank you, Joyce. It was nice talking with you.
Thank you, John. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Basil Tsiolkas, you can give us some dates and locations.
Sure. Doc NYC will take place starting November 10th, and it runs through the 17th. Our regular homes of the IFC Center, the SVA Theater, and the Cinepolis Chelsea. Information can be found on our website, docnyc.net, and people can follow along at our various social medias at DocNYCFest.
Excellent. And by various social medias, you mean Facebook, Twitter, you know.
And Instagram, yeah.
And Instagram.
All that jazz, yeah.
All of them. Well, Basil Tsiolkas, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl and sharing this information about Doc NYC.
Of course, thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, thanks, bye.
Speaking of John, you know, playing beside him was about the greatest experience I could really get. You know, playing with him and standing beside him, I heard things that I never thought of, you know, of doing, because John had a way of playing, and with the breath control, with the kind of breathing that he does some type of rhythmic breathing that I haven't, I'm still trying to find out how this is done. You know, all of a sudden it seemed like as you sat next to him, when he started playing, it's almost like he'd take my breath out of my, you know, he it made me feel like I'm, you know, I'm trying to breathe correctly, and my breathing is going rhythmic with what he's doing. You know, it's like an off beat, but he's it's not quite off beat. It's just him. You know how he feels about it. You know, and that kind of approach is the way he plays. The sound is coming from all kind of like directions. because when he breathes, you know, already made a run, you know, and when he come down, it may turn into something else. So it's very difficult to really talk about his style of playing, you know. Not hear other people trying to. I think just leave that alone, you know. The way John was playing, you know, he was playing like he wasn't going to be here the next day. It sounded like whenever he played, he gave it all up every time you hear him. Now, not because maybe the sound wasn't great or got some problem with the electronics, you know, he just played all over that stuff, you know. He mattered to hear. That's hard to do. I haven't accomplished that yet. I'm still having problems with sound, you know. The microphone is not right. I don't feel like playing on the barrel. I've got these issues, you know, that I shouldn't have. But I'm trying to be a better musician, be a better person, too. So.
Listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl, I'd like to thank Basil Tsiokas of Doc NYC for the time that he spent with us, and John Scheinfeld, who is the director of Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary. What we're listening to in the background is Song of the Underground Railroad from John Coltrane's Africa Brass. It's a 1961 Impulse Records release. Before that, we heard Living Space, the title track from John Coltrane. It was originally recorded in 1965 on Impulse Records. This is a 1998 MCA reissue. John Coltrane on tenor and soprano saxophone, Jimmy Garrison on bass, McCoy Tyner on piano, and Elvin Jones on drums. Before that, we heard Alabama from Coltrane Live at Birdland. That's a 1964 Impulse Records release. Once again, the lineup is John Coltrane on tenor and soprano saxophone, Jimmy Garrison on bass, McCoy Tyner on piano, and Elvin Jones on drums. Before that, we heard The Blessing from Don Cherry and John Coltrane. The Avant-Garde is the name of that release. That's a 1966 Atlantic Records release. Don Cherry on trumpet, John Coltrane on soprano saxophone, Charlie Hayden on double bass, and Ed Blackwell on drums. Before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Following Song of the Underground Railroad from Africa Brass, we're going to close out the program with another selection from John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, Resolution. Sugar in My Bowl will return on November 27th with our special guest, bassist Dave Holland. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you.
Hello? Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.